Good morning. A bill moving on Maui would ban single-use polystyrene to-go containers. We'll talk with a county task force and Surfrider Foundation member who disagrees with the claim that the change could add consumer cost. And we'll get this week's read of the news from Neil Conan. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. It takes a lot of work to make what you do look easy, as every stand-up comic knows. Longtime comedy performer Bo Irvine looks into the secrets of his craft. And Sunshine Express is more than 40 students from Kalaheo Elementary School in grades 3 through 5. They're preparing a Dickens of a Christmas show.
It's Tuesday, November 29th. Stay here for the conversation right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
You know, when Styrofoam first came around, it was hailed as kind of a blessing and was quickly adopted by all kinds of manufacturers, yeah?
Well, this is true, but we know now that this blessing also came with a lot of detrimental effects.
Sure,
you know,
did,
because,
yeah.
Yeah, people like the fact that it's cheap and it's light, and that's all to the good, perhaps, but we all know that it doesn't biodegrade. That's why supporters of a proposed Maui ban on styrofoam say that it's time that their county take the lead, and it appears that it has. The bill moved out of committee yesterday. It's now going to the full county council. We're going to talk a little bit about it today with Lauren Bickley. She is she's a member of the group Rise Above Plastics, and she's its coordinator with Surfrider Foundation. Also, she is involved with the local marine debris there, trying to make sure that there isn't any more of it than we see happen periodically. She's on the phone with us now. Good morning, Lauren. Are you there?
Good morning.
Thanks very much for joining us. I saw your Facebook post yesterday. A lot of very happy people that this bill made it through committee and is now going to the full council after a very long time, it seems, of trying to get it to that point.
We're very excited. We've had some people working on this bill since 2007, and I've personally been working on it for close to 3 years now. So it was a big step in the right direction.
Why did it take so long?
You know, we have continuously shown a lot of community support over and over, countless times, 20 supporting the bill, you know, two or three testifiers opposing the bill. It comes down to a lot of the misinformation about prices, about alternatives to compostable or to polystyrene products, and just a lot of misinformation and fear-mongering. But we've really worked hard within our community and worked directly with our restaurants to show them that there are alternatives that are good for the environment and still good for their business.
So, for example, we know we've seen some of them that, in fact, we've used here at the station, but we always hear that that's going to add cost to the bottom line, as you just mentioned, that you've been trying to dissuade restaurant owners from that perspective, which, you know, you're trying to bust that myth a little bit there. What are the best alternatives that come in at roughly the same price point as Styrofoam?
That's a great question. And actually, you know, I'm sitting here looking at 40 pages from the San Jose County in California of different alternatives to polystyrene. So there's a myriad of products out there that fit anything from a Simon bowl to a plate lunch. And we have a couple of local distributors who provide these products directly. A lot of the products are very comparable in price. And what we've always said is that this is a pass-through cost. So ultimately, if a restaurant is paying a couple cents more for an alternative product to polystyrene, that's going to see on a customer's bill of maybe 5-10 cents. A number of restaurants already charge an additional 25 cents if you take a takeout container.
For that additional cost, would they in fact be telling a customer and making, you know, in fact a sales point out of it that they're using this kind of takeout container as opposed to the traditional styrofoam and actually show that cost on there?
Some of the restaurants currently do. A number of restaurants don't charge additional. So, you know, that's part of our bill, and what we're working towards is just to educate the restaurant owners here and show them that ultimately we don't believe that this is going to affect the bottom line. We have over 4,000 restaurants in San Francisco who, you know, range from really large chains to small mom and pop stores. And most of the bills, and including the San Francisco bill, have these hardships written into them. And we actually have emails directly from our San Francisco coordinator. And he was, you know, personally went around, talked to thousands of these different restaurants, and not one of the restaurants has applied for a hardship. So we really don't think that the price is an issue. And as the bills are passed, it's ultimately going to drive down the price point of these alternative products anyway.
I want to just talk to you a little bit about something we've been dealing with for a long time in Hawaii, the idea of getting rid of plastic bags. And then people were saying, but there are some bags that actually do biodegrade. And then we were told that those bags don't, in fact, really biodegrade, that they just break down into such small pieces that we can't readily identify them, but they're still there. Do we have any real scientific background to show that the products that we're bringing in to replace styrofoam aren't just disappearing from view, but they're actually disappearing?
Yeah, so you bring up a kind of interesting conversation about biodegradable versus compostable. So what we're really advocating is a 1-2-C approach, that a product's either a 1 or 2 recyclable plastic or compostable. Biodegradable just means that it's going to break down, but it's not necessarily going to go away. It's going to stay in that toxic form. Compostable means it actually returns back into natural elements. And so the products that we've been working with restaurants to have are these compostable products, a product that is plant-based, not petroleum-based, not one of the types of bioplastics, but a product that will ultimately return back into the natural environment and break down, you know, even if it's on the side of the road versus a polystyrene container that's never going to go away.
So what are these containers made out of? Are they corn-based?
Actually, many of them are sugarcane-based or bagasse. We have a number of pulp-based and paper products. So trying to move away, again, from what we call bioplastics and really utilize the plant-based products that are more of the pulp and paper and sugarcane and byproducts like the bagasse.
At this point, with the bill going now to the full council, do you have an expectation that this is going to move through after all this time and all the work that you've done to make your case?
I feel really confident with the Maui County Council. Again, we've repeatedly shown widespread community support. We have close to 1,000 signatures on change.org. We have countless amount of testimony. We had 20 students show up from Kihei Charter School to testify yesterday and support the bill. We've had numerous high school students and the Maui Huliao Foundation who have repeatedly shown that this is something the community wants. This is something that the restaurant owners are embracing and working towards. And I do think that the Maui County Council has seen it, and it's in the Maui County Island Plan, and it's also part of the Aloha Plus Challenge. We have to move to zero waste. We're an island. This makes sense. And we've got to take the next step forward, and I think they understand and recognize that.
Lauren, we're all islands, and yet it seems to be that, in this case, Maui is taking the lead. Is this creating a model for the rest of us?
I truly, truly hope so.
If that's to be the case, is there already activity going on other islands to be able to spread this a little wider than Maui?
Absolutely. Big Island has been working on a bill over the past couple of months. Oahu and Kauai are constantly working as well, and we have chapters, surfrider chapters on each island who have been working with local coalitions. We've also launched the Ocean Friendly Restaurants Program, and it's a statewide program. It's the first statewide program of its kind in the nation, and it's a voluntary program that recognizes restaurants who have taken steps to decrease their single-use plastic consumption. And we have almost 100 restaurants statewide who have joined this program and, again, are voluntarily taking these steps to reduce not only polystyrene but other single-use plastic products. So we are creating a groundswell, and each of the islands is working towards, you know, that zero waste and reducing single-use plastics.
Well, thanks very much for giving us an update, and good luck to you with this. We'll be watching.
Thank you guys so much.
Lauren Blickley is the Rise Above Plastics Coordinator with Surf Rider Foundation, the Maui chapter. She's also a local marine debris activist and researcher. She was the lead author on a Maui-based marine debris study published in 2016 and was a member of Maui's polystyrene task force convened in 2014. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:14. Coming up, a former federal firefighter plays it for laughs. But first, your backyard quiz.
O Mau, o Kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
Coming up in the show, we'll be hearing about the craft of comedy. So in today's Backyard Quiz, we'll be taking a look at a local comedian. The man we're thinking of was born in the 1950s of mixed Filipino and Hawaiian heritage. He got his start in comedy opening for fellow comedian Frank De Lima at the Noodle Shop in Honolulu. Our funny man caught his big break in 1978 when he joined the comedy trio Booga Booga, replacing the deceased Rap Replinger. He would eventually go on to win Hoku Awards for his solo work and even made appearances on a number of TV shows. Today we're looking for his name, and if you can be the first one to call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, you and your HPR prize can laugh all the way home.
I'm Troy M. Apostle from HittingTheStage.com. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Picture yourself in front of an audience with no props or costumes or musical instruments to play, just a microphone. Your assignment, get those people to laugh. It's the kind of task that's made many a performer's blood run cold, but it's one that Bo Irvine has taken on for more than 20 years now. Bo makes it look easy, but it isn't. There's a lot of craft and the lessons of experience going on behind the mask, and Bo's with us to tell us how it all worked. Good morning, Bo.
Good morning.
It kind of has to look easy, doesn't it?
Yeah, yes. Sometimes it doesn't feel easy, but yes, it's.
Well, I can't imagine how it would ever feel easy.
Yeah, but yes, it has to look easy. If you show any kind of, you don't want the audience to have the upper hand. As soon as they know you're not doing well, they tell you.
It's like I always tell you with wild animals, they can sense fear, right?
Yes, exactly. So you have to go up with no fear.
So how do you get rid of it?
I've been doing it so long. Every night or that I go on stage, yes, I have a little fear. But you get rid of it just by – I get rid of it at the first laugh.
Yeah.
You know that's how – you know, in the beginning it was tough because, you know, like I said, you want to make sure you're in charge, and sometimes the audience takes charge.
Well, that first laugh – you know, depends on a lot of things in the audience that are beyond your control, who they are, what their,
right.
You know, their whole sort of cultural thing, their age, any number of factors. So suppose you go for that first laugh and you don't get it. How do you adapt to that?
Well, you have to know how to shift gears. Actually, you try to find a common denominator, mm-hmm. and then when you start, you know, I've been like I said over almost close to 30 years now. Mm-hmm. You start to you know when to shift gears, or you listen to the audience, or you find that common denominator. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't know the audience, then obviously you have to find them. But then you write jokes, you write jokes that are guaranteed jokes, or you do a current event joke. You know, or something that the people in the town that you're at experience, like in Hawaii, traffic. That's mm-hmm. an easy. I mean, tourists know it. You know, shortest distance between two points on this island is under construction. Everybody knows that. If you just drive in the island, so yes.
So in a way, part of the ingredients of a laugh is a sort of a commonality of experience, huh?
Right. You find, you know, if you go into, I think we were talking about that the other night. If you go into a town and you're in Maine and mm-hmm. you're talking about, you know, something in the mountains.
Surfing,
yeah, yeah. Then it, you know, they have no clue.
Yeah.
Or if you're at a place that has no, you know, people don't do a lot of air transportation and they ride buses and trains, and you're talking about flying in an airplane, they're looking at you like, I've never been in a plane.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you have to find a common denominator, and you have to do jokes that are you know, regional and to them. People ask me all the time, well, you do Hawaii local stuff and then you go to the mainland. Well, I just change it around mm-hmm. to wherever I'm at.
So have you got kind of a memory bank in your head of a lot of different jokes in different sort of, file cabinets in your brain of thing?
Yes. People always say, God, you're such a great ad-libber. Well, I'm not. They're just jokes that I've ad-libbed before.
Yeah.
If I get in that situation, it sounds like I'm ad-libbing. And then there are times, yes, that I truly ad-lib, you know, because you don't know what someone's going to say or yell out.
But sure.
In general, yes, I do an hour and a half of comedy now. And I probably have 3 hours. I just can't remember it all.
You know, I've got a friend back in New York who's studying at one of those comedy schools, and he spent years getting 10 minutes together.
Yes.
So an hour and a half—that's a lot.
Well, that's years.
Yeah.
Yes, and you're exactly right. You know, when a young comic comes in and says, "I'd like to come work for you guys," and he says, "I've got 10 minutes," and I say, "How long have you been doing comedy?" "Oh, 3 months." I go, "Okay, come back in 2 years."
Yeah, right.
And then you'll have 10 minutes. It's not an easy gig. And usually they're that, as we were talking about, that 10 minutes, you can't have them on stage anyway.
Yeah. and it might be the wrong 10 minutes.
That's what I'm saying. You can't have them on the stage anyway, right? You know, people when they first start think, and I did too, you know, the things that are not funny are not funny.
Yeah.
You know, and your we talked about that. Your friends will tell you you're funny. You know, and perfect strangers will go, "No, you're not."
Well, yeah. I mean, we just did a show together over the weekend, and you know, everybody else had something, had something to sort. You know, I had my guitar to hide behind. Singers had their songs to sing, and it always strikes me with a comic, he just gets on stage with just a mic.
Yeah, it is tough. I will say that, but you know, it's fun. It's a challenge. Like that thing we did over the weekend, that was a challenge. As mm-hmm. you saw, the first night I did I did different things. And people said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "You know, sometimes I don't even know until I walk on the stage."
Yeah.
You know, I because I'm feeling the crowd. You know, I look out and see who's there and what's there, and I just start off. And then hopefully it works.
What kind of cues, when you do that, and you've only got a few seconds to sort of scan the crowd and get the feel
right.
of the room, what kind of cues would trigger some, you know, would let you know what's going on out there?
First, I listen to the crowd. I was taught this a long time ago by a guy named Steve Bluestein. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, when the people come in and they're talking and they're having a good time, it's going to be you're going to have an easy time.
Yeah.
You're going to have an easier time. Let's say not easy, but an easier
right.
time.
Mm-hmm.
If you come in and it's like Borthwick's mortuary and everybody's just sitting there and they're not, you know, I'm serious.
Lost their best friend.
Yeah, they just lost boss, and you're going to go, now you have to work. So
yeah.
then you in your mind, you think to yourself, do I want to do my real work stuff? You know, you have to find that common denominator again. You have to shift gears.
Yeah.
So like the other night I walked out. The first night I didn't do this. The second night I walked out. I said, I live in Kailua. How many people live in Kailua?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I go, can I get a ride home? you know. So that got them, that hooked them to me, you know, because I had a play, and a lot of people, the audience, there were a ton of people, as you heard, screaming from Kailua. So
yeah,
that's the first common denominator with them. They're going to like me because I just brought up Kailua.
And you also sort of, you take a standard intro line, and it goes from a cliche into a joke.
Yes.
With the ride home.
Yeah, can I get a ride home? Exactly.
Line. So.
Yeah, I just got here. Can I get a ride? Or, you know, if you've heard, you know, the traffic's so bad, or, you know, I just got here. I just flew in from Minnesota.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
So, yeah, so wherever, you know, so you try to find that common denominator.
Well, you made me think, Bo, of the kind of structure that a joke has, and how you have a kind of a setup. You know, guy walks into a bar, whatever.
Yeah,
there's,
right.
There's a thousand standard setups.
Exactly.
And then the setup and the payoff. And between the setup and the payoff and the punch line, timing plays a really important part, doesn't it?
Right, because if you wander on and get too, you know, off into the weeds,
right,
then you lose your punchline. So it's got to be boom, boom. And jokes come in threes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I try to do them in threes. You know, I will tell you, like the driving joke, I'll try to do three things in the driving joke, sometimes four, mm-hmm, depending on the that way you're leading them down. You got to tell them the story and then do a punchline. A lot of comics, young comics, I don't want to say a lot of comics, a lot of young comics, they don't understand that yet. You know, and that's something I had to learn. And I learned, I was fortunate. When I started back in the 80s, I worked with some really good guys, you know, mainland comics a lot, you know, and local guys too, really good local guys.
I really think it's an underappreciated aspect of performing arts, because it's so, you know, comedy's so hard to understand what is that works and what doesn't.
Yeah, and you know, you have to let it go if it doesn't work. I don't know if that makes sense. You have to let it go if it doesn't work. And a lot of guys will go, this is funny, and I'm going to continue trying to make it funny. It's going to be funny. And you just got to let it go.
Yeah.
Or while you're up there, new material, when I do new material, it's in the middle of my set. Some were buried in the middle. So if it doesn't work, it doesn't matter. It's a throwaway.
Yeah.
And then I will tell the people, oh, that joke didn't work. I'm working on that. You know. Or if it really worked, I said, I do a thing. I'm going to keep that one. Thank you, folks. I just wrote that.
That kind of gets them with you.
Yeah, because they know. I work with a gentleman, George Wallace. He'll come up all the time with a pad of paper and a pencil. And I've worked with him. In fact, he was one of the first ones that saw me ever perform back. And he'll do jokes like he's doing new jokes, but he's not. And the people love it because, oh, okay, you guys didn't like that one. And he'll check it off. Or you really love that one. And then he'll throw a new joke in, you know. So you don't know what he's doing. But his hook is that pad and pet. When he comes up as a guest set. Now, when he has his act, he doesn't do that because now he's up doing George Wallace.
Well, Bo, we'll bring you back as a guest when you've got some new jokes to try out, all right?
No, I don't want to do that on the radio.
You'll never know if they're laughing
exactly.
or not.
Exactly.
Right? Bo, thanks a lot for coming in. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you all very much.
Sure. Bo Irvine is a comedy performer who appears at Honolulu's Halekoa Hotel Tuesdays and Saturdays. And you can learn more about him and his work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Everything's y'all. I was at Delta at the counter there at Delta about 6 months ago, 12 o'clock at night, by myself checking in. Lady goes, y'all going to Honolulu? And we're going, yes, we are. All of us right here. We're going to Honolulu. Honolulu.
Hawaii Public Radio is grateful for the support of our listeners and for our many community partners, including the Hawaii Review, KTUH, and the School for Examining Essential Questions of Sustainability. Thank you all so much for your generosity and participation during our recent on-air campaign. It's a long-time fact. Homeless people congregate in Honolulu's Chinatown. And it's why many social services agencies are there and why even understanding businesses sometimes wish they weren't. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair is back with today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning. Back barely, Beth.
Oh,
excuse me.
Oh, oh, boy. Poor thing. Well, there is so much tension in Chinatown, and that's not necessarily because there are merchants who don't care, because many of them do. They're not unfeeling of or unaware of the plight of the homeless who are there. But they also are there to do business and to keep their businesses running. How do you balance those two things seems to be the place where we always are.
Yeah, and it's a constant struggle. This is something that Carl Rhodes, the area representative, now the senator, said, how do you strike that balance? And our two reporters, Natanya Friedheim and Noel Fujii, actually opened their story with the River of Life Mission, an organization that really does terrific work. It has a number of beds for people. It feeds 15,000 people monthly. But what happens to the businesses next door? There's a floral shop, for example, that says we're losing 3 hours of our business every day because all these homeless people, drug addicts and others, congregate in Chinatown. And if they had their druthers, they would have groups like the River of Life Mission actually move out of Chinatown.
But the River of Life is usually so careful to keep people away from the merchants and down the side of the streets that that doesn't have any storefronts on them.
Right, but this is the problem, is that people wander around and you can't exactly control that. Now, with the new development, finally, Pauahi Hale is set to open. It's been planned for a long time.
You mean Safe Haven at Pauahi Hale?
Correct. Safe Haven will be moving in there. It's a 25-bed shelter, and it's been at Fort Street Mall for a number of years now. But now it's going to be moving into Pauahi Hale, and there are a lot of people worried, including a florist nearby that I mentioned earlier, as well as someone who runs a smoothie shop and makes those bubble drinks. They're very worried about how they're going to be able to coexist. Now, the neighborhood board in the area welcomes Safe Haven going into Pauahi Hale, as does the Chinatown Business and Community Association. But many other people are saying they're just tired of Chinatown becoming a dumping ground for all these problems. Why does it congregate in their neighborhoods when they can't go to other places? Why can't there be greater services elsewhere?
And what we hear from service providers, it's, well, because they are there and they have been there for such a long time, and that's why they've had to co-locate to be able to serve them. You've got to meet them where they are.
Exactly. It's that classic catch-22. I think the bottom line, the takeaway, the kind of thing that we've been talking about for a very long time is affordable housing and more treatment for everybody is really going to be the only solution. But what do you do when it's NIMBY, not in my backyard? And this is something that you and I are going to continue to talk about, I'm afraid, for a long time, hopefully once I have my voice back, too.
Exactly the point. Well, listen, take good care of yourself, and we'll see if we hear you tomorrow.
I hope so. Thanks, Bethany.
Take good care, Chad. Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
And now a different look at the news. As an acrimonious recount gets underway in 3 states, arguments among the Trump transition team go public, the endgame approaches in the siege of 2 major cities in the Middle East, and the death of Fidel Castro. Those are just some of the stories on the mind of news analyst Neil Conan. He joins us now, as he does most Tuesdays, from his Macnut farm in the Big Island. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
I want to talk to you first about that recount. Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein is challenging the count in the 3 states that were decided by very narrow margins, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan. She's raised millions to pay for that effort, but even she says that she doesn't expect the results to change. So why do it?
Well, for one thing, the Green Party is relevant for the first time in this election. Dr. Stein has raised something north of $7 million from mostly Democratic donors whose names and email addresses will now be on the Green Party's lists. And she plays into the hopes who cling to the belief that, you know, Russia or the vast right-wing conspiracy or somebody hacked voting machines to elect a candidate who ended up losing the popular vote by, well, more than 2 million votes.
So far, though, Neil, there's no real evidence of any of that hacking. You know, the Obama administration did accuse Russia of interference in the election. We all heard that. But that had to do with email hacks of the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton campaign chairman's John Podesta.
Right, yeah. And we're going to have to see how the Obama administration responds to that before they leave office. But absolutely no evidence that the election was hacked, and no reason to believe the result is going to change. No reason to believe the vice president the president-elect's assertion that he would have won the popular vote if it hadn't been for what he called millions of fraudulent votes. And, you know, I think, is the telling moment here. The man who won the election became angry when the Clinton camp decided to send lawyers to attend the recount, and angry again over her ever-growing margin in the popular vote, and didn't hesitate to tweet out a demonstrable lie that demonstrates, undermines our faith in the democratic process that just elected him. It's bizarre.
Yeah, true, but maybe it's no less bizarre than, you know, his campaign manager taking to Twitter and the Sunday morning talk shows to attack a man her boss is still considering to be the next, you know, Secretary of State. We heard more about that this morning, about Mitt Romney going.
Yeah. As you know, I do not think Romney is going to get that nomination. We talked about that last week, and for the very reasons that Kellyanne Conway mentioned. He called Donald Trump a con man and a charlatan, among other things. Of course, Trump fired back at him, but you're right. It's extraordinary to see a senior Trump advisor attack a potential nominee in public when Romney has another appointment in Trump Tower for dinner tonight. Conway got credit for imposing discipline on her candidate in the last stages of the campaign, but this suggests chaos amongst his most senior advisors.
We've got to move on a bit here. I want to catch up with you on some of the international stories. Now, several have been crowded out by our focus on American politics. In Aleppo, though, it looks like rebel resistance is collapsing after such a very long battle.
Yeah, Syrian government forces have broken through the areas long held by the rebels in Aleppo. Many thousands of civilians are trying to find a way out now. If Aleppo falls, it's the last major urban area held by the rebels. It would be a major loss for them, an important victory for Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian president, who just a year ago just seemed to be on the ropes.
So what happened, Neil? What changed, and how did he turn things around?
Well, a year ago, the Syrian army was exhausted, low in morale, and low on men. Since then, Iran sent in regiments of Iraqi and Afghan militias and cadres of its own Revolutionary Guards. The Iranian-backed Lebanese militia, Hezbollah, committed its forces, and, of course, Russia intervened as well, and not just with airstrikes, but with important supplies of weapons and ammunition for those weary Syrians. And that's what turned the tide in Aleppo.
Neil, once this war is over, whenever that is, Iran and Russia will presumably want to have some kind of payback, won't they?
Yeah, and you mentioned an important caveat. Even if Aleppo falls, the war, I don't think, is anywhere close to being over. But yes, Assad will dominate in the western part of the country, which is by far the most populous part of the country. Much of that country will be in ruins, but Russia will come away with permanent air and naval bases on the Mediterranean and with increased influence throughout the region. Iran will presumably demand more Shia influence in a majority Sunni state, but various rebel factions do still hold some areas in western Syria. Even if Aleppo falls, lower-level conflict is going to almost certainly continue. There's the northeast of the country where Syrian Kurds hold sway. And, of course, then there's Raqqa, the capital of the ISIS caliphate. ISIS positions in Iraq are crumbling as grinding attacks continue in Mosul, another major city of the Middle East that will be in ruins. And forces are now assembling for an assault on Raqqa itself.
In the interest of time, I want to move on a little bit to another story in this last week that captured the attention of generations, the death of one of the most major international figures of the last half century. Fidel Castro led the army that overthrew a corrupt dictatorship in Havana and established a communist bastion in the Caribbean. And he defied 11 American presidents. I mean, this is sort of a seminal moment, isn't it?
It is. And among those presidents he defied is, of course, Barack Obama. After Obama went to Cuba this year to thaw the long freeze, Fidel published a long letter that basically said, you know, we don't want your Yankee dollars. But, of course, his more pragmatic brother, Raul, is now in charge. You know, there's been so much debate over a legacy that, for Fidel Castro, included the murder of thousands of his political opponents. He left his country in deep poverty, and he's been in severe repression for the last half century and more. That's all on one hand. On the other, there's near universal literacy, and Cuba's public health system is greatly admired. His legacy includes the many in Latin America inspired by Fidel Castro's communism and anti-Americanism, and there are deep reverberations of that movement in many places, no deeper than in Sandinista Nicaragua and in the still developing disaster in post-Chavez Venezuela.
We got to go in about a minute or so, but I want to ask you about the question now that seems to be, what's the future of the Raul Castro regime and American policy under a President Trump, who, as you mentioned, has vowed to reverse Obama's policies?
That will turn out to be easier said than done. On the same day that Fidel died, the first scheduled U.S. airliner landed in Havana. Flights will soon be up to 150 a day. U.S. hotels and cruise lines are there to deliver hundreds of thousands of American tourists. U.S. ranchers and farmers are selling agricultural products to Cuba. So, you know, support for these policies, the Obama policies, is not just from Democrats. Donald Trump may well try to unravel it, but as I said, I don't think it's going to be easy.
You know, with the tumult in the U.S. election, we haven't spent a lot of time on international news as we usually do. Are there any stories that you quickly want to point out?
There's a lot of them, of course. The world sure doesn't stop for the U.S. election. One in particular to keep an eye on is the fighting between India and Pakistan in Kashmir. Relatively low level, at least for now, but ambassadors have been withdrawn in anger. There was a big attack today on an Indian army base. Kashmir has led before to wars between India and Pakistan. But, you know, winter is coming on there, which makes military operations at those extreme altitudes even more difficult, so we may get a breathing spell from the weather.
All right. Well, as much as we'd like to go on and on, time is finite. We got to go. We're going to leave it there for this week. We'll talk to you next.
You bet, Bethann.
Thanks, Neil. You can always hear Neil Conan here on Hawaii Public Radio with his specific news minutes, and he'll be back with us next Tuesday.
Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. This is Catherine Klein. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. The people who settled the islands of Oceania were what is known as a canoe culture. Their lives centered on them. Their canoe was their island. These vessels ranged from the smaller racing canoes, or va'a kailoa, to the massive double-hulled oceanic canoes such as Hokulea, which are called va'a kaulua. Two legendary racing canoes from the 1920s, the Malolo and the Naya, fell into disrepair and were feared lost. They were sister canoes, for they came from the same koa tree. Recently, the two sisters were found on Hawaii Island and reunited in Panaeva. Because of grants from the Hawaii Tourism Authority and the Hawaii Community Foundation and others, restoration was begun in 2012 and completed this past April. The work was done by the Pa'apono Milo Li'i Malolo Project. This organization teaches many things Hawaiian, so it was not a surprise when they turned the restoration into a learning experience for island children. The Malolo for the sisters will be at the start of the Milo Li'i Canoe Club's 2017 racing season. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
And there'll be a lot of benevolent minds who'll be out there today involved with Giving Tuesday. Now, for today's backyard quiz, we asked you to give us the name of a Hawaiian comedian who rose to prominence in the 1970s and 80s. He started doing stand-up comedy around Honolulu at age 23, opening for Frank DeLima. He did a brief stint with comedy trio Booga Booga before returning to solo work. He achieved success in fairly short order, winning a Hoku Award for Most Promising New Artist in 1979. From there, he went on to win three more Hoku Awards for Best Comedy Album in the 80s and 90s. He was also a presence on both the big and small screens, making appearances in several TV shows and films, including recurring roles in Raven, Marker, North Shore, and Baywatch. Earlier this year, this local funny man was diagnosed with cancer of the lymph nodes. True to form, when he made the diagnosis public, Andy Bumatai said, "Lymph nodes, doesn't that sound like a band that would open for Coldplay?" And we send Andy Bumatai our best wishes for a complete recovery.
And Beth Ann, Rob Kay knew the answer, knew it was Andy, so he's today's winner. And at 8:47, that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. There's a reason Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol is revived and reinterpreted every holiday season. It's about generosity and what giving really means, and it's full of valuable lessons for young children. Lane Griffith has been Kalaheo Elementary School's music and band teacher for more than 20 years, and he and more than 40 of his charges from grades 3 through 5 have put together a musical version of the classical story called Dickens of a Christmas. It's on a week from Friday, and Lane is on the phone from Kauai. Good morning.
Good morning.
What was it that attracted you to this story, Lane, for your kids?
Oh, well, I've always loved the Dickens of a Christmas, the Dickens story. It's just been one of my favorites since I was young. I remember the Magoo Christmas Carol, and that was kind of like one of my first introductions to the story, and I just loved it.
Mr. Magoo, yeah. Well, that's one of the things about the story is it can be adapted. It's been adapted any number of ways, yeah?
Right.
Do you talk to the kids about what the lessons of the story are?
Oh, we do. We do bring that up about how it is a story about a transformation between from... you know, more of our base instincts into something that's more about, you know, finding that place inside of us that is full of joy and happiness.
Well, you know, kids, especially your kids are in grades 3 through 5, and,
right,
you know, that's an age when the presents under a tree are a big deal for kids that age, right?
Absolutely.
What are you going to get this Christmas? Do you find that that's kind of part of their world at that age?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. But I think there's also something more in these kids. They also are more in touch with, you know, than all of us busy adults with what is what really genuinely makes them happy. And what they do get that message, I think.
So in a way, it's easier for them maybe to understand the spirit of a story like this.
I think so. I really do. I think it was it got me at an early age, and I think it gets them as well.
Yeah, actually, I think for most of us, our experience of the original Dickens story come from childhood. And in a way, I think Lane, maybe it brings about. And anybody who hears the story, the kind of transformation that occurs in Scrooge.
Right.
Because we all have a little grouch in us, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. And the girl who's playing, we actually have an interesting twist because this version that we're doing is a girl plays the Scrooge role.
Uh-huh.
And she plays it as a girl, as a woman.
Uh-huh.
So, and she takes it on with a vengeance. She really plays up the Scrooge part and just has a ball with it.
It can be fun.
She gets the transformation into.
Well, it can be fun for a performer to be mean in a setting like that, yeah?
Exactly.
And that's what she's doing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Aubrey is she lives it to the hilt. She really does a great job.
What kind of things have you talked with her about in getting her ready for the role, or did she just sort of pick it up and run with it?
No, we talked about it. We went through and said, this is an amazing transformation this person has, and you need to be able to make that believable to your audience. And you have to feel, you know, that part in you that really is, you know, miserly and doesn't want to give, you know, and cranky, and you have to live that up. And then you also have to find that other side. So she really took it to heart. She learned the part really well, and she's really lived that.
Well, because in a way, Scrooge can't be so mean that he or she doesn't get any sympathy after the transformation, right?
That's right. Yeah. And she does. She gets plays it in such a way that you still have some sympathy for that character.
That's an awfully subtle, that's a kind of a subtle aspect of character for a young kid to get, I would think.
Yeah, I think Aubrey is, she's really pretty mature for her age. She finds it, though. I think she really does make it believable. I think it's going to be, and the audience is really going to get that when they watch it.
With 40 in, what do you have, more than 40 in the cast?
41 or kids we have this year.
So what are the other roles? Is there a sort of a chorus, or what are the other kids that are doing up there?
We have, yes, this we have a there's a group of kids that come in as the volunteers that ask for money for Scrooge, that group. We have big chorus numbers that involves the whole, that kind of helps set the scene, and that involves the entire group. We have a group of, if you remember, the story has Mr. Fezziwig in a party at his place, and there's a big dance, and we have a big dance number, and kids are involved in that one. And, you know, all the way through, there's stuff for everybody to do. We have the Cratchit family also. And they have a big part.
How much rehearsal time went into this show, Lane?
Oh, we have been rehearsing every Saturday since early August.
Wow.
So these kids have put in a lot.
Are they pretty disciplined
bunch?
Not just
the kids, you know. We also have parent volunteers who are who make costumes. And we also have full sets that people have to construct. It's pretty major. Not only that, but we also take those the show. We every year it's a tradition with this group to go into our local parades. We have two parades that the kids are involved in. They sit in these beautiful train cars that a parent made many years ago. A group of parents made many years ago, and we sing the songs from our show, and we've done that for years.
That sounds like a lot of fun, Lane. That's why they call it the Sunshine Express, right?
That's right. You got it.
Thanks so much for talking with us, and have a great time with the show. I appreciate
it. Oh, we sure will. Thank you so much for having me on.
Sure. Lane Griffith is the Kalaheo Elementary School's music and band teacher and the director of the school's special performing group, Sunshine Express. It'll be performing Dickens of a Christmas, a musical based on a Christmas carol by Charles Dickens, on Friday, December 9th at 7 p.m. in the Kalaheo Elementary School cafeteria.
How do you explain what it feels like to circle the Earth in zero gravity at 17,000 miles an hour?
You are weightless. It's magic. You're Superman. You know, you can fly.
Commander Chris Hadfield describes the view from the International Space Station, and we look for legendary buried treasures in England.
And the Holy Grail is to be found somewhere within the Glastonbury area.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
This afternoon at 4, right after Fresh Air.
Beth Ann, was A Christmas Carol part of your young childhood? That
always,
story?
Always. And with my kids, too, to be able to read it out loud over successive nights. And there's a reason why we all keep coming back to it, not just because it's one of those, you know, quintessentially Christmas things, but because the message is so good, and seeing it reinterpreted at different points and various movies ad nauseum. But still, there's a good reason for that. We need to hear that message.
We always hear about the sort of the onslaught of materialism at this time of the year, and it's kind of a little parable about what generosity really is.
Well, that and the Grinch, too.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, the whole point of where do you place a lot of your emphasis? And obviously, there's nothing wrong with material things or the pursuit of them, but when it all comes down to it, what's really important and how we show that at this time of year or at any time of year, that seems to be the lesson we need to carry.
That it is. That it is.
That's going to be it for us for the moment. But, you know, there have been increased reports of racial and anti-Semitic incidents happening since the election, and it may be tempting to just point your finger at Donald Trump, but our contributing editor Neil Milner says that there are far more complex reasons we all need to understand. He'll be here tomorrow with some of them.
And Pulitzer Prize winner William Finnegan relives his barbarian days.
Meanwhile, you can get in touch with us anytime that you like. We have a 24/7 talkback line at 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, and I'm on Twitter at BKOZHPR and Instagram.
Past shows are on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandergert.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of the Conversation.